Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We have four bills on the work session agenda today. I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2637. Colleagues, you have dash one amendments to this bill in front of you. This is, I don't know if it's our, is this our first gutting stuff, maybe?
Could be.
Might be our first gutting stuff of the session.
Oh, we might have had
I want to bring. Sure, we did have another one. It was my bill that we gutting stuff.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's right.
Children in custody, of pair of mothers
that's
in custody,
true.
I think
that's
that was,
right.
Yeah.
That is right. And we appreciate you again for offering that bill up for the for the stuffing.
I left my name on it.
So why don't we bring up J.L. Wilson, and then if you want to come up, and then we'll just take a little testimony on the Dash 1 amendments. You want to start, J.L.?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson representing NFIB, House Bill 2637. The Dash 1 amendments represent a complete gut and stuff. I want to be very clear that 2637 is deleted in its entirety, and what's inserted in the House Bill 2637 is the language that was formerly House Bill 2967, the A engrossed. I want to be clear that every member of this committee voted in favor of that bill when it was on the House floor about 2 weeks ago. It was a 55-1 vote. Let me briefly go over the bill. The bill requires a regulatory flexibility analysis on rules pertaining to small business. When an agency decides it wants to undertake a rulemaking process, we ask that you define a small business, and they're in Section 2, as a business that employs 50 full-time employees or fewer, or has gross sales of less than $6 million. Section 3 is just a preamble that states some legislative findings with regard to the cost of rules on small business. Section 4 asks that an agency, when adopting a rule, provides an estimate of the number of small businesses subject to the rule, the projected reporting, record-keeping, and other administrative costs for compliance, and a statement of probable effect on small business by the rule itself. Section 5 asks for an agency to determine if a rule has an adverse impact on small business, that it undergo a regulatory flexibility analysis that would show if there's any less stringent compliance requirements for small business that could be enacted, if there could be less stringent schedules or deadlines for small business that could be enacted, or whether you can consolidate or simplify compliance or reporting requirements, or perhaps the establishment of performance standards as opposed to design or operational standards. All these, it asks the agency undergo a look and see if these options might not be applied to small business in the rulemaking process. So as a way to pay for this measure, because obviously this requires a little bit extra workload, and agencies came back with fiscal notes, we asked that the triennial rule review, that is every 3 years agencies are required to review their rules and go over them. It was more important to us in the business community to have better upfront analysis than back-end analysis that didn't do anything. So we proposed to pay for it by eliminating the triennial rule review in favor of better upfront analysis of a measure. I will say that the only department that came back with a fiscal was the Department of Employment at $64,000, and for that reason, I would ask that the committee move the Dash 1 amendments, but move them to the Ways and Means Committee from this committee. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, why don't we wait on questions, Jill? If you'd go ahead and...
Yeah, just very briefly, my name is Patrick Allen. I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. The office was created by executive order of the governor to help state agencies work to improve the state's business climate by making our business regulatory environment faster, cheaper, easier to comply with, simpler, and less expensive for business. The Dash 1 amendments to 2637, as Jill has said, replicate a bill, House Bill 2967, that has already been heard and is sitting in the Senate. Wanted to reiterate some points that he made in terms of the intent of the bill is very good, and we agree with it in terms of its ability to have agencies do a better job of taking into consideration the business impacts of rules. But you got to know that doing that isn't free, and I concur completely with JL's recommendation that you refer this to Ways and Means, because the bill really hasn't had a as 2967 has not had a very full airing and analysis of what are the costs and what are the offsets of elimination of triennial review.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrilly.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2637.
Representative Sherrilly moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2637. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? The Dash 1s are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrilly.
I move House Bill 2637 to the, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Was that with the due pass?
Yes.
With the due pass.
Representative Sherrilly moves House Bill 2637 as amended be moved to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Excused.
Representative Krasowski?
Aye.
Representative Sherrilly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye.
House Bill 2637, as amended, goes to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, gentlemen, both for your testimony. We're now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 880. Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 880, we took up, I believe it was 2 days ago, dealing with the supersedious undertakings on tobacco settlement cases. We have some new amendments.
Only one ring. If it's two rings, we throw the gavel at you.
It's out the window.
Go ahead.
We've just received the A7 amendments. I want to go through the amendments so we can remember where we are. The A5s are the ones that we dealt with and looked at last time we met that would make for tobacco settlement, tobacco manufacturers would stay a judgment with a $100 million bond, even if the judgment was more than $100 million. There is an A6 amendment, which the chairman asked me to have drafted, which would make that supersedious bond applicable to any civil judgment that is a private civil judgment in which the state is not a plaintiff. And lastly, the A7s, which we Nancy just passed out to you, are the amendments that Pete Shepard, the Deputy Attorney General, spoke of and had. I think they were just in theory, or we have them. Just got them back from LC. I would prefer to have him explain them because I just got them.
And I'm sure, Pete, you're busy reading them, or have you read them already?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I just received them, as you did, but I did work directly with Mr. Hendricks of Legislative Council, so I think I can give you a summary. In sum, they do track the conceptual amendments that the single sheet of paper with the conceptual amendment that we proposed yesterday. On the first page in Section 2, the presumptive amount in lines 13 and 15 is established in the bill. If the amount of the judgment is for less than $100 million, then the presumptive amount of the bond is the amount of the judgment. If the judgment is for $100 million or more, then the amount presumptive amount is for $100 million, notwithstanding the fact that the judgment exceeds that amount. Then in successive subsections of the bill, in subsection 3, starting on line 16 on page 1, the judgment debtor may come before the court and justify according to the criteria that are spelled out in A through D the reasons why the judgment debtor ought to be allowed by the court to reduce the amount of the undertaking. And then in subsection 4 of the bill on page 2, beginning at line 14, corresponding provisions are provided in which a judgment creditor may come before the court and establish, according to the reciprocal in effect of the same criteria, the reasons why the amount should be increased beyond $100 million to some greater amount, even up to and including the amount face value of the judgment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the third page of the bill, the draft faithfully reflects the portions of the concept submitted to the committee, which include the idea that it might be necessary to conduct some further discovery to establish the factual basis for raising or lowering the amount of the bond. And the draft specifically provides in lines 13 to 14 that materials submitted to the court in connection with those proceedings can be received under an appropriate protective order to protect sensitive financial data that might be involved. And then on lines 15 to 17 of page 3, the Attorney General is given statutory authority to appear in these proceedings because of the state's financial interest in these cases.
Are there any questions for Mr. Shepard about the A7 amendments? Okay, thank you, Pete. Colleagues, based on the testimony we heard a couple of days ago, I just, in noodling this idea over, one of the things we heard was that this treated, proposed amendment treated tobacco companies sort of specially or differently than other people, other entities. And so the A6s were just sort of an afterthought to that discussion. I'm not necessarily proposing them, but I figured to bring them forward so the committee could at least have the option that if one of your concerns was that it somehow treated the tobacco companies unfairly, that one of the policy choices that the committee could make, as had been made in other places around the country, was to not single out the tobacco companies from the settlement standpoint, but to basically just apply this $1 million bond to everybody in a private civil action. And so that's there for your thought if that's an issue that is of concern to you. But it seemed like as a matter of policy, we at least ought to have that amendment in front of us as we discuss or deliberate on this issue.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crummell.
Question. With regards to the A6, would they be in addition to the A5 or instead of the A5?
No, I think they'd have to be in addition to the A5.
They would be in addition to the A5. Right. And then would they be so it would be then the policy of the state that any time that somebody is sued, that if they want to appeal, if they lose their case and they want to appeal, that they would have to appeal, they would have to post a bond of the amount of the judgment or $100 million, whichever is greater or whichever is lesser.
To the extent the judgment is affirmed, a supersedious undertaking of $100 million acts to stay any judgment for recovery of $100 million or more entered in favor of a plaintiff other than the state. So to the extent that the judgment, that the base judgment was in excess of $100 million, the $100 million would be the amount that you would post. So if you had a $250 million judgment and you weren't a tobacco company, say you were an automobile manufacturer,
right,
or a drug company, you would still post the $100 million.
Okay.
If it was less than that, then you would post the amount of a judgment.
Okay.
Right.
And then follow up, if I may. And that is with regards to in favor of plaintiff other than the state. So if the state is the plaintiff, then what happens?
Say this again to me. I'm sorry.
It says on line 10 and 11, or more entered in favor of a plaintiff other than the state. What happens if the state is the plaintiff?
Counsel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, then you would have, there's a supersedious undertaking can be applied for in any case, but there wouldn't be a bright line. I think that we talked about that where this would make it $100 million. It wouldn't really be the judge's decision on that case. So if it's a public, if the state was the plaintiff, you would fall back on basically the law that is now, is currently the law of Oregon, which is they would apply for, the defendant could still apply for a supersedious undertaking to stay the judgment in any case, but it would be up to the judge in that case rather than a statutory limit.
Okay.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Chair, do we have people representing either the plaintiffs or the defendants who might comment on the reducing the $100 million or increasing the $100 million on A7? Can we hear any testimony on...
Well, sure. We can bring up... Mr. Talman, you want to come up and talk about that?
Sure.
Representing...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson, and members. I've, of course, am familiar with the concept that was discussed at the meeting on Monday, and this is the first time I've seen the actual language. It does allow justice to be dispensed in this sense at the time that a judgment has been entered on a case-by-case basis rather than a one-size-fits-all basis. So in that sense, we would be in favor of it. The way it's drafted, of course, is it still singles out, as the chair mentioned, the tobacco companies for treatment that is not accorded or afforded to other litigants, but it does allow each side, as it's drafted, the opportunity to make their arguments to the court who is sitting there in judgment to alter the, depending on the equities, to alter the flat $100 million limit. As I indicated before, I oppose any type of special treatment, but certainly this would allow a broader level of justice, if you will, or at least the parties to have their day in court than the flat $100 million limit in the A5s.
Do you have another question, Representative?
Mr. Kamen represents the plaintiff or the
yes.
defendant?
Yes. Right.
Do we have anybody here for the defense?
Well, we do. Representative Sherley?
No, just.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, Representative Ackerman, I'm sorry.
I have a question for the panel here, not for the witness.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Kalman.
You, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Ackerman.
I'm looking at existing law, ORS 19.310 sub 2, which states the court may waive, reduce, or limit an undertaking upon good cause, etc. I don't see that any of the amendments repeal that statute. Am I correct, counsel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, you're correct. I think the one that's closest to it is the A6 amendment does go to 19.335, which is the basic supersedious, but it does not amend the portion that you of a discretion. That's correct.
And with respect to A5, isn't that an irreconcilable conflict? Unless we intend A6 to supersede that somehow.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, I think when I had those written, I still think that it's a trial court. It allows a trial court to waive, reduce, or limit any and undertaking an appeal. That's a good question for how they would interrelate with the new language. If the judge would still have discretion, I
you're talking about the A6s, Representative, or the A5s.
I think the 5 and 6 would apply.
Yeah, and again, 6 was simply offered as to raise the policy discussion about whether or not we wanted to limit it or not limit it.
I see the A7 as being more consistent with existing law because at least there's a hearing process to reduce the amount of the bond. That's why I don't think that 19.310 is necessarily inconsistent with A7, which is basically my preference, but I think it.
Right.
Causes a problem with respect to the other two amendments.
I'm not sure how it, I mean, it would allow reduction. It just simply says that it's an amount that it may not exceed. I guess I don't see how that's necessarily inconsistent.
Well,
waive, reduce, or limit. So to the extent that it sets a ceiling but still allows the court to waive, reduce, or limit below that ceiling, I'm not sure that creates an inconsistency.
Well, only if the lid is an absolute amount. I mean, if the lid is an absolute amount, you still have a statute allowing you to waive or reduce that. I just believe there's an inconsistency if we go A6 or A5.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
I guess I'm with you on the A5s. I don't see them as being inconsistent. That establishes a maximum. Within that maximum, the court still has discretion to waive, reduce, or limit.
Yeah, that's...
I don't see that. Do you want a motion?
Yeah, sure.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've got a meeting in 10 minutes, so I'd like to get on with this. I'll move the A5s just to get this underway. To me, the A6s are broader than we need to be. The A7s, I'm not too, if you don't mind a speaking motion.
Even if I do, I'm not sure it'll matter.
Too disinclined. I sure see it as engendering a lot more motion practice and post-judgment discovery as well, which... I'm not sure that I want to complicate this with all of that element of the process, so I'm inclined to the A5s, although as we get to the bill, I think I was hoping we would see an amendment that would also address that language there on lines 22 and 23 of the bill. If we recall, that it seemed we didn't need that language about the judgment being an amount greater than $1 million, since $1 million isn't pertinent to the bill with the elimination of subsection 2. So if we get the A5s in, I'll propose a conceptual amendment after that.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, yes. Representative Shirley, thank you for bringing that up. And I had the A6s took that language out, but I agree. I did not get the A5s amended to do that, and I apologize for that.
Okay. All right. So the motion is to adopt the dash A5 amendments to Senate Bill 880. Is there discussion on the motion, Representative Przanski?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to be opposed to the A5s. I guess in the speaking motion that Representative Shirley had, I question how many times on the A7s are we going to see these type of judgments actually going to be landed in this state where we're going to overburden the courts. I think that the A7s is one that will actually accomplish what we want and give that process that we're concerned that's already in statute to allow for the parties in those very unique and judgments or situations to be able to demonstrate why the cap shouldn't be applied. I've not heard any testimony here that has given us that our court systems run amok with $100 million judgments.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, thanks. I was speaking to that.
Your speaking response.
Yeah, just that actually every case, as I see this, is subject to a motion one way or another under the dash A7s. If you look at sub 3 beginning on line 16 of page 1, that relates to civil actions in which the judgment amount is for less than $100 million. Then you can have a motion by the judgment debtor to reduce the amount. And then in the case of on page 2, line 14, in any civil action where the judgment amount is for more than $100 million, then you have that motion practice. So where you have one section applying to judgments under $100 million and one section that applies to judgments for $100 million or more, that to me covers the waterfront of judgments, and I think we would see a lot of action on those.
Okay, Ann, why don't we call... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'm going to vote against the dash fives. I am against an artificial setting of a lid. I don't mind the breaking of those lids if there's a factual record to do so, but to arbitrarily or artificially set a lid, I think bothers me because I would like to see a factual basis for that made in the record of the case. That's why I favor the dash sevens provide that mechanism, and I believe existing law, as I stated before, ORS 19.310 sub 2 also provides for a hearing process if someone would like to reduce the or limit the undertaking on appeal. So for those reasons, I will oppose the dash five amendments.
All right. Well, we better call a vote then on this one. Ann?
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Tomlin?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, which amendments are
we
voting on?
We're voting on the adoption of the A5s. You picked an auspicious time to arrive, Representative Edwards.
Get the chance to be in right.
Your vote is no.
No.
All right.
Representative Pazonski?
No.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
No.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
That's why I make the big bucks. Votes aye. The A5s are in.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I will make, a conceptual amendment to the bill as follows. On page 1, line 20, after the semicolon, insert the word and.
Mm-hmm.
And on line 21, after the word plaintiff, delete the semicolon. And the word and insert a period and delete lines 22 and 23.
Representative Shetterly moves a conceptual amendment to the amended version of Senate Bill 880, beginning on line 20 after the semicolon, inserting the word and on line 21, deleting the semicolon, deleting the word and inserting a period, and deleting lines 22 and 23 in their entirety. Is there any discussion on his motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the conceptual amendment is made to the amended version of Senate Bill 880.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Senate Bill 880 as amended, including the conceptual amendment to the floor, that it pass.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 880 as amended, including the conceptual amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Pazonski?
No.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
No.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 880 is amended, moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is amended and conceptually amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pazanski.
I'm going to give notice of possible minority report. We'll let you know if we're going to move forward on that.
Appreciate that. Notice is duly noted. Assigned Representative Shetterly as the carrier of the bill.
Thanks.
All right. We're going to now go to a work session on Senate Bill 189. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 189 is a speed racing bill. We heard about it, I think it was a little over a week ago, briefly in our discussion of this bill. This is the Engrove Speed Racing Bill 189 deals with organizers of a speed racing event, and briefly, it would only apply to the person who organizes a speeding or a racing event, which is pre-planned and coordinated, involves two or more vehicles, and includes the activities described in 811.125, which is the current speed racing statute, which is currently a violation. So this would make it a higher crime to actually organize one of those events. I believe it was Representative Crummell that brought up the issue that is addressed in subsection 3 of the amendment, and you should have the hand-engrossed bill with the A2 amendment, which reads, a person who organizes a speeding racing event is not in violation of this section if the person has a permit from the road authority for the highway on which the event takes place. That was written in response to some of Representative Crummell's questions. And real quickly, speed racing, the violation includes a person drives a vehicle or participates in any manner in any of the following in which a vehicle is involved: a speed competition or contest, an acceleration contest, a test of physical endurance, an exhibition of speed or acceleration, or the making of a speed record. And Troy Costellas is here from ODOT. This is his bill. If you have any questions.
Mr. Costellas, do you want to come forward? Who else testified at the original hearing on this bill, Craig?
I believe, Kelly, did you testify on this? I believe it was only Troy.
Mr. Chair, we talked to the victim's stepfather.
The stepfather of the victim. Right, okay. Was that it?
and City of Portland, but in reference to Senate Bill 90.
Mr. Landauer testified as well. Okay. Are there questions? Well, first tell us about the A2. Do you have any objections to the A2?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for ODOT. And the A2s referred to the question by Representative Crummell as well as Representative Brzozinski about not catching in the net an organized sanction event in this new item. And we have no opposition to the dash twos, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Costales about the bill? All right. Thank you, Troy.
Thank you.
Mr. Lemon, it's always a pleasure to have you sitting here in our committee. and I could tell that was so heartfelt. No. So was mine. Is that what you were suggesting?
Yeah.
We understand each other. do you want to come up just a second and talk to me about the fiscal on this? I've seen that the Judicial Department, seven cases would become felonies instead of traffic violations is what they're predicting.
Mr. Chair, members, Phil Lemon from the Criminal Justice Commission. We have not been able to talk with a lot of law enforcement officials on this bill. I was able to talk to a traffic sergeant in Portland who said that his estimate was if one in 100 of these went to a felony status, he would be surprised. And so I think the number you have from Judicial Department reflects that amount.
So do I break my ways and means barrier on this one if I don't send it down there?
If it's at 7, there would be no referral required.
All right. That's what I needed to know. Thanks, Bill. Okay, colleagues. We have the Dash A2 amendments in front of us on Senate Bill 189.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I'll move the Dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 189.
Representative Crummell moves the Dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 189. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the amendment? It's adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I'll move the Senate Bill 189 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves Senate Bill 189 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kowalski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 189 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Crummell, would you please carry?
Sure, I'll carry it.
All right, thank you. And that takes us to the last work session of the day, colleagues, Senate Bill 564. We'll open that work session.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate Bill 564, with Senator Atkinson was here with Corporal Gettings from Grants Pass. This is a bill that deals with a new crime of assaulting a law enforcement animal. I believe that we had testimony, and when we did, Representative Brzozinski raised a what looked like a drafting concern on the portion of this that dealt with where this measure should be set in the sentencing guidelines. At the request of the chair, I set a couple options for the committee, and that is reflected in that you have an A4 and an A5 amendment, and I'd like to go through those two. The A4 amendment would take out the section of the bill that would have told the Criminal Justice Commission where to place this measure, and it would just say that it's a Class C felony. A Class C felony is punishable by up to 5 years in prison and $100,000. And it would be, this is, I guess, the normal course of business would be that the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission would meet and would set the sentencing guidelines for this. That's the A4s. The A5s would retain lines 26 and 27, which direct the Criminal Justice Commission to set this as a Class 6 on the sentencing guidelines. That would make it the same as assaulting a public safety officer. Of course, assaulting a public safety officer would be a knowing infliction of a physical injury. This is knowingly causing serious physical injury or death, but it They're both would be Class 6s, I believe, and Phil may be able to correct me on this. I believe the animal abuse that we have now is a 3 or a 4. 3. I'm seeing a 3. So this would be a higher seriousness than animal abuse. However, the A5 amendment takes out the what I guess would have been an aggravating factor if the injury occurred during a resisting arrest or attempting to elude. So those are the two options. And, Mr. Chair, I wanted to also, Representative McPherson raised an issue when we had this about resisting arrest that I never addressed, and I wanted to real briefly put that on the record and see if this answers his questions. First of all, use of force by a police officer in an arrest, we've gone over this on some other bills, but it would be the reasonable force necessary. So in any case where an officer uses unreasonable force, that can be evaluated. And, of course, a defendant who was arrested in that manner can make a civil rights action based upon as unreasonable use of force. Your question, I think, particularly dealt with resisting arrest and the fact that in Oregon statutes you may not use any physical may not physically resist an arrest, and this does not change that. So that I think your question was, would this impede that? And it does not. I will say also that in the Senate, this same issue came up, and that is why on lines 22 and 23 of the engrossed bill, it says the injury or death occurs while the law enforcement animal is being used in the lawful discharge of the animal's duties, and that was language that was it was hoped that that would bring it into that structure of using reasonable force in making an arrest.
Representative McPherson.
Yeah, I want to probe that a little further because the concern I had that I was pursuing in the question in our prior session of this was that. If a police officer tells me to halt, or gives me the instruction to do something, and then I know that he's acting under a legal authority, and that resistance, and I can anticipate how much force he's likely to apply. Whereas when a police animal, no matter how well trained, is then applying that force, I'm not sure that I, as the person being pursued, have the same understanding about what level of force that animal is going to apply, and it seems to me that a certain amount of
so much pressure per square inch is what it's going to do.
I was recalling a vision. I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm pursuing something that's not worth talking about here, but I am concerned about whether this bill in effect creates a situation where acts of violence perpetrated at a police animal are the same as perpetrated on or nearly the same as a police officer, whether that's an appropriate measure of law.
That's a very interesting question, and I'd like to just recast it a little bit. I think in a normal arrest situation, if the arrest was lawful but excessive force was used, there would be a civil rights violation. I also think, by analogy, if the a law enforcement animal got out of hand and inflicted grievous wounds upon someone when it was not necessary, and you use reasonable self-defense, if you committed a felony, that seems like it goes pretty far.
Well, I tend to like the A4 amendments to the bill, which gives the Criminal Justice Commission the appropriate authority to set the level. I think that's a sort of reasonable compromise as to where this thing ends up, and let them take into some consideration the balance of the other crimes and determine whether it's more like the intentional abuse statutes or whether it's more like a public safety officer or whether it's something in between. I can't not share the note, though, that I got from Senator Atkinson, who, as you know, is rather glib and creative in his Brother Max, can you let my police doggy bill live and have a hearing? There is a bone and a pat on the head in it for you. I appreciate it, Jason. So just thought you'd appreciate his
humor. Representative Brozanski.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. I think the A4s are the more appropriate ones because our normal process in this policymaking is to allow for the Criminal Justice Commission to take in all the different factors. And when I looked at the sentencing guidelines, there are a number of person crimes that were even below the level that we would be potentially elevating it up, and I feel very uncomfortable with that. I would like to get one point clarified from counsel. My looking at the engrossed copy for the dash A4s on the bottom of page 1 and continuing on page 2, we would be removing the resisting arrest out as one of the factors. And the reason I bring that up is because in my dealing with law enforcement that have canine units, the only time that I've ever seen canine units being used is usually when someone is fleeing or eluding the scene and they release the dog to bring the dog down. And back to Representative McPherson's, the amount of force that that dog's going to use is whatever the pounds per square inch that jaw has, because if you're moving, it's going to lock in on you. The only other time I've ever seen the use of these type of canines is trying to secure a building that's usually in the dark. The charge the officer gives is either you come out, I'm sending a dog in. If the dog comes in, you know, basically beware. And I know from, let's say, some dogs, as well as they're trained, will still react to stuff that may not actually justify the force that's used by a dog. In fact, on even officers have been bit by a canine unit when they're standing still. And so any type of movement, that dog does respond to it. And it's pretty, I will say, if I was in a building and I got the command that there's a dog coming in, the ones that I've seen, they actually have them with a blinking light. You can only imagine what you would be thinking as you saw this blinking light coming at you.
That I ought not to be in the building being told to come out with my hands up. Representative Jensen.
Interesting discussions here, but following a little on Representative Ackerman's point that excessive force by a police officer, one might have the legitimate course of a civil rights action. Are we going to accord the alleged felon the same rights if it's excessive force by a canine?
I believe, Representative, that if the canine reacts in a matter that creates injury, substantial injury, that would call into question the use of the canine, either based on his training or his previous activity, just like an officer. I mean, there's going to be a record. And if, the same way that a police agency gets sued under a civil rights 1983 claim for having a cop who has, on several other occasions, used bad judgment and gotten himself into trouble, if that happens again, typically what happens is that lawsuit or action is brought against the department. That officer's record is reviewed, and the case can be made to the jury that they failed to properly supervise, discipline, train, etc. Representative Barker's probably monitored for his union numerous instances of those kinds of cases over his years in the force, and the same would hold true in this kind of a case. And if, in fact, the evidence could be put forward to the jury that the individual was substantially injured and that the department failed to appropriately handle the situation, there would be a violation, and they would have to pay some amount of damages under the civil rights law accordingly. And I don't see it being any different in the case of a dog inflicting that kind of injury that's in the service of the police agency than I do an individual.
I, in part, I anticipated this answer to be the answer, but I did want to ask that question specifically, so that I'm sure that what the intent or knowledge of the...
Sure. No, and it's legitimate, and I think that's currently that would be the case right now. I mean, none of this is new. I mean, to the extent they're currently using a police animal that behaves in a manner that's inappropriate or that goes beyond some mark, they're subject to that kind of claim, just like if they use smoke grenades when they shouldn't have, right, that burns a building down or some other kind of
even
activity.
We've got Hutch, who's smarter than the police officer who's accompanying him.
Who's going to represent the dog at the time of the crime? Well, that's an interesting question.
My question is, would they bring in a dog psychic to speak for the dog to let the people know what the dog was thinking?
Maybe.
Check with representative.
There is such available at this time.
Yeah.
However, if it's out of the indigent defense fund somewhere, it could cause a major problem because there aren't that many.
Well, you'd have to hire him in Oregon. Representative Anderson.
Well, I can't offer you a bone or a pat on the head, but this is a good bill because the corporal who presented this to us is from our city, and we've had marvelous experience. And I really like the fact that this is bringing bringing us up so that an officer and the dog are pretty much on the same level, not in that sense, but that we're protecting the officer and giving him status because of the animal. So I'd like to move the A5 amendments.
Oh, you're moving the A5s?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Representative Anderson is moving the A5 amendments to Senate Bill 564. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crumble.
I, like you, tend to sort of like the A4 amendments. If the A5s went out, I would not oppose the bill. I think it's a good bill. But I do have a little bit of, I'm not even sure I would call it heartburn, but concern about telling the Criminal Justice Commission to put it at a particular level that is the same as a human officer. I think that that making it a Class C felony does make sense if a person injures or kills a law enforcement dog or horse. But I think to tell the commission that they must make it a Category 6 versus leaving it at a Category 3 and being able, and for the court being able to bring in all of the other factors relative to whatever the crime is. And I appreciate Representative Przanski's comments about resisting arrest and that sort of thing, but I think in some respects that is sort of a given. And I would agree that the person is going to have, you know, if they think that they've been dealt with unfairly or more harshly than they should have been, they would have a civil rights action that they could bring. So I think that, to me, the A4s are the amendments that really seem to kind of make the most sense. And so, unfortunately, Representative Anderson, I'm going to oppose the adoption of the A5 amendments.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, find the A4 amendments preferable. I think, perhaps on a personal basis, elevating it to a Category 6 might not personally bother me. But I'm afraid that we could get a lot of negative flack for this when some of the things, the injury or to the human being, may not fall that high on the crime category. As a consequence, I would be reluctant to vote for the A5 amendments,
okay,
but would support the bill enthusiastically support the bill with the A4 amendments, and probably will, with reservation, support the bill with the A5 amendments.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, I was under the impression that this would give more flexibility by bringing the commission in. I had missed the point about the Category 6. So I'll withdraw my motion and remove the A4s.
Representative Anderson moves the dash A4 amendments to Senate Bill 564. Any discussion on that?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I will support the A4s and the bill with the A4s in, but I would like to put on the record a concern about the point I was trying to get at is not, even if there's not excessive force being applied, even if the force being applied by the police animal is appropriate to the circumstances, that the actions of the, say, the fleeing suspect in relation to the animal are different from the actions that that individual might take with respect to an arresting officer, and I think understandably so. So I think I would like to encourage the Criminal Justice Commission to bear in mind that distinction, that we really are, I don't, it would not be my intent by passing this bill to put the police animal into the same position as if they were a member of the force, and acts of violence perpetrated on the animal being just the same as if they were perpetrated against a police officer. I don't think that's a fair kind of situation. I think it's a lesser kind of situation, and I would leave to their discretion than that judgment.
Okay. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will mostly apply when somebody either stabs a dog or horse or shoots one, which has happened. And I apologize for chuckling, but at one point I was in charge of the Portland dogs, and I was thinking back on a few instances, one where a guy ran who was later mad at the police saying, "You really could have caught me. You let me go so the dog could catch me instead. And if I'd only had my video camera, we would have had a Dancing with Wolves scene that not to be forgotten that night." And a couple other instances which were, that's why I've been over here chuckling away. But anyway, I'm going to support the A4.
All right. Then I'll just do it this way.
Is there any objection to the A4 amendments as moved by Representative Anderson? Hearing none, the A4s are in the bill. Representative Anderson.
Yes, I move the Senate Bill 564 with the A4s to the floor with the due path recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves Senate Bill 564 as amended by the dash A4s to the floor with a due path recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative
Cummel? Aye.
Representative Aye. Representative
Aye.
Representative Jenner?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice
Chair
Anderson?
Aye.
Senate Bill 564 as amended by the A4s goes to the floor with due pass recommendation. Representative Barker?
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
All right. Okay. With that committee, we stand adjourned.